Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. When does war really end for a combat veteran? And what can be done for the 20-30% of American veterans who return from the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan with post-traumatic stress disorder and whose suffering can persist long after they return to civilian life? David Finkel writes and edits for The Washington Post and is the recipient of both the Pulitzer and the MacArthur Prize. His 2009 book, The Good Soldiers, profiled men assigned to the 216 Infantry Battalion in Baghdad during the surge of U.S. troops in Iraq. His latest book follows a number of them back to life in the U.S., where, as he discovered, for many it is far easier to get home than it is to feel at home. That book is called Thank You for Your Service. David Finkel, are you with us in the studios of The Washington Post?
I am.
Oh,
we
welcome.
Do have some studios here.
Excellent.
So I hope you can. Can you hear me okay?
Sure can. Great.
Great. Good deal.
So The Good Soldiers was very well received, had a big impact, I think, on helping American readers understand the experiences of some of our soldiers. It had to have been, though, for you, an emotionally exhausting project. How did you decide you wanted to follow up, and was that an easy choice to make?
Well, yeah, I came back after spending about 8 months on the ground in East Baghdad in a pretty rough neighborhood that the 216 was in for their deployment during the surge. They came back. It's fair to say they went over with a good sense of a good deal of patriotism, a sense of mission, and they had a rough time. And when they came home, they had been degraded by the experience in so many ways, and I wrote their story in The Good Soldiers, and thought that was the end of it, that I had written the account I wanted to write. After the book came out, a lot of them started getting in touch with me to say that they weren't doing so well, they weren't feeling right, they were anxious, in some cases depressed, in a few cases feeling suicidal. And at some point, after enough of them were saying the same things, it dawned on me that I had written the first half of the story, and the second half still needed to be written. Hmm. And that's what this new book is about. It's the second half of the story.
Well, you open the book with Sergeant Adam Schumann, who was this stunningly effective soldier for the better part of three tours in Iraq, but finally realized he had been pushed to the breaking point.
Right. So Adam Schumann was regarded as one of the great soldiers in this battalion of 800-some soldiers, maybe the best. He was, when I met him, he was on his third deployment into Iraq. He had been in combat, by his count, for about 1,000 days, had performed well, had performed terrifically, and then just couldn't do it anymore. I found him because I was asking around one day, who's a great soldier? A couple people mentioned this guy's name. I found him a few days later. I walked into his room and introduced myself, and he said, well, I guess I know why you're here. It's to watch me leave the war. I had no idea, but he was packed up. He was sitting alone in his room waiting to leave. He had talked to his wife, who had said she was a little scared of what he might be like when he got home. And I walked with him to the helicopter out of the war. And this guy was just so filled with a sense of guilt and shame over having to leave, over what he had become. The helicopters took off, and away went Adam. And the new book starts with him. It's 2 years later. He's back in Kansas. He and his wife have just had a baby. And they're in bed in the middle of the night. His wife is just so tired and wants to get some sleep and asks if he can take the baby. And he says, of course I can. He takes the baby. She falls asleep. This guy who simply can't get better falls asleep as well. And the baby rolls out of his arms and off the edge of the bed, hits the floor. And then their story of the afterwar is underway at that point.
Yeah, you're right. This is has stuck with me. He is sorry. He is always sorry now. He's been sorry for 2 years, ever since he slunk home from the war. It's like he has this sense that he will never do anything right again.
No, he did come home with that sense, and he had done everything right, at least in terms of how you fight a war. He had fought honorably. He had led well. He did whatever we might ask of a soldier, whether we agree with war or disagree, he had performed well, but he's not thinking about that. He's just thinking about he's the guy who couldn't finish the job. And as I said, he came home feeling so guilty, and it has defined him since then. It continues to.
Yeah, and it still seems to take him by surprise when he talks about, like, his second tour of duty. He loved it. There was adrenaline running, and even when he was in danger, he felt like he was on top of things. It almost sounds like that moment at which the symptoms of something like post-traumatic stress disorder set in, they just take people by surprise.
Yeah, well, that's certainly the case with him and a lot of the people I write about in this book. I mean, if I can talk about another guy for a second, there's a guy I write about named Tesolo Ayeti.
Yeah.
And Ayeti is somebody I met during their time in Baghdad. He was in a vehicle. He was in a Humvee, five guys inside. And one day it ran over some deep buried explosives and it was blown sky high. And it came down, and Ayeti had a broken leg, got out of the vehicle, made his way back to it as it caught on fire, and pulled two guys out, helped pull two guys out. But he couldn't get to the driver, a 19-year-old who burned to death in the driver's seat. And I was with Ayeti that day. I wasn't in that convoy, but I was with him at the aid station as he was being worked on, and I was with him when he found out that... that the driver, a kid named Jacob Harrelson, had died, and that's Ayeti. He went on from there, and it took a little more than a year for him to finally crack open. And because what had happened, what kept happening, and what he would tell no one about was a dream he would have almost every night, and he couldn't stop having. And the dream was Jacob Harrelson on fire saying, "Why didn't you save me?" So it doesn't matter. Again, in his case, he couldn't have acted better. Broken leg, comes back, helps rescue two guys, but the guy he keeps dreaming about is the one he didn't get to.
David, did you get the sense that the narrative we've created about our heroic soldiers adds to the weight of the guilt these men feel when they can't get everything done?
No, I don't think so. Well, let me think about that. It's a really interesting question. Maybe in the widest sense, at first, it sets up some expectations they might have in mind. But after watching these folks, first in war, and then living with them for a couple of years and their families after the war, I think what became clear to me is it doesn't matter what your expectations are, what you're thinking. Once shame hits and it takes hold of you, it becomes a very individual thing that's hard to break free from. It doesn't matter what anybody else is expecting, because even afterwards, people would tell Ayeti, "You were heroic, man. You deserve a Medal of Honor. You deserve a Silver Star, at least a Bronze Star with Valor, something." It didn't matter to him what anybody else would say, because how he thought of himself, the shame he was carrying for whatever reason, is what defined everything else.
How many of the 2 million American veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan wars are now coping with traumatic brain injury or post-traumatic stress disorder or both?
So the best estimates I got there are 2.5 million Americans who have joined the services since 9/11. Mm-hmm. And of the 2.5 million, 2 million, according to the Pentagon, have gone directly into Iraq or Afghanistan. The best estimates at this point are of the 2 million, 20 to 30% have some type of psychological wound, primarily PTSD, but also traumatic brain injury, which is the psychological damage that occurs when, to put it bluntly, your brain is just all rattled. And so that works out to about 500,000 Americans. Have come home or will be coming home from these wars with varying degrees of mental wounds. Now, so as long as we're talking numbers, it's worth stressing that means 1.5 million have come home okay.
Yeah.
They're moving on. In some cases, as I say in the book, their lives are better for the experience of having been to these places. But 500,000, that is a significant number. And if you multiply it by wives, girlfriends, mothers, children, family members, this is a a coast-to-coast thing we're dealing with. Every community has its wounded soldier. And the book has only been out for a few days, and I've already gotten a little bit of blowback from people saying, doesn't this book perpetuate the stereotype of the broken soldier? And I have to tell you, I'm a little baffled by the emails, because the fact is there are broken soldiers because of these wars. And to pretend otherwise is almost disrespectful of what they're trying to convey in this book, the experiences they're undergoing every day.
What is a diagnosis of something like PTSD, David? What does it mean mm-hmm. in terms of the kind of care that a soldier or a veteran is eligible to receive?
The care is well-intentioned, but a bit haphazard at this mm-hmm. point. I mean, the fact that there's a system of care at all is new to this war. When guys came home from Vietnam, there was no system in place. I mean, of course, you come home from every war. There's a certain percentage, 20, 25, 30% of the people who fought who come home mentally wounded. And in the past, there wasn't a system to try to take care of them, to accommodate them. Now there is a system. There are attempts in active military. There are attempts in the VA system after the military. But just because there are programs doesn't mean it works for every guy. And the folks I followed in this new book, I mean, they show how haphazard it is. It's the system of care exists, but it's overwhelmed. It's inconsistent depending on what locality you're in. And these guys I write about and their families, they all eventually did find a way to get some help, but it doesn't mean that they ended up in a program because it was the very best program for them. They got in a program because there happened to be an opening, and you grab it, and off you go, fingers crossed, and hope for the best.
And sometimes the bureaucracy is maddening even just to read about. There's a point where Ayeti goes to receive some help, and he has to get, is it 39 signatures to sort of prove that he has been to this place?
Yeah. So one of the things the Army did when it became clear that there were going to be a lot of mentally wounded soldiers who needed extra attention, they set up these things called warrior transition units. These eventually became warrior transition battalions, which is bigger than the unit in a way because there were so many guys. But let's just call them WTBs, where they would have caseworkers, they would have a pharmacist, a dedicated chaplain, dedicated staff to help these guys heal to the point where they could either go back to their unit or leave the Army with some kind of plan and skill for civilian life. Great idea, great intentions, but you know, the reality is these things are inconsistent. It depends where you end up, whether you're in Fort Hood in Texas or Fort Carson in Colorado, or Fort Riley in Kansas. It's a luck of the draw thing. So in the case of this guy, Ayeti, whose memory was so ragged from what happened to him, who had difficulty doing anything, more than a couple things in a row, when he got into the WTB, he was handed a list with 39 names on it, 39 offices, and the intent was go around, get to know the place, check in, make sure you get a signature from all these people so we know that you've met the pharmacist, so we know you've met the chaplain. But in fact, I mean, this is a guy who couldn't find his car some days, so the idea of him finding 39 places spread over a big post was good intentions colliding with absurdity.
My guest is MacArthur Prize-winning journalist David Finkel. He writes and edits for The Washington Post, and he's the author of the new book, Thank You for Your Service.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can learn to navigate the ever-changing digital landscape with the Social Media and Digital Communication Boot Camp, June 4th through 6th at SMU in Plano. Details and registration at smu.edu/think.
I'm Chris Boyd. You're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guest this hour is Washington Post writer and editor David Finkel. He joins us today from the studios of the Washington Post, and he's the author of the new book, Thank You for Your Service. Another alarming problem for returning veterans is the rise in the number of suicides among active duty personnel and among veterans. Can you give us some perspective on how those rates seem to have changed in recent years?
It's hard to compare this war to recent wars because the military only got serious about keeping suicide statistics about halfway through the Iraq and Afghanistan wars, around 2005, 2006. Before that, there are really no numbers. Since they've been keeping numbers, I mean, we all know this, the number of suicides has been increasing every year, and most recently, it was hitting about, one a day between active and reserve. This is not including people out of the Army, the military, people in, whether active or guard or reserves. So it's about one a day. And last year, it exceeded the number of combat deaths, which drew a lot of attention. But, you know, the thing about all these numbers, whether it's the rise in suicides, the report we see that DOD spent close to $1 billion last year on mental health treatment, which was double the amount in 2007, or the fact that we have 500,000 mentally wounded soldiers. I mean, I don't know about you, but at some point to me, they just become so abstract, almost lose the effect. And so to me, it's much more effective at this point, instead of seeing these numbers, to read about, Adam Schumann's wife, Saskia. I mean, here she is. She's taking care of her husband, trying. None of them knew what they were getting into when he went to war. And now they're dealing with it the best way they can. And to see her write in her diary one night, "My heart feels like it's about to explode." To me, at this point, this helps me understand what these numbers are all about. And it's the same with suicides. Yes, the number of suicides are going up, but to me, that the extent of this became clear when one of the things I did in this book was write about a guy named Pete Corelli. And Corelli helped run the war in Iraq for a while. He was a four-star general. He came home. He was promoted to vice chief of the Army. And one of the briefs he was given was to try to figure out what's going on in terms of mental health and suicides. So Corelli convened this meeting at the Pentagon. It was a once-a-month meeting it would be in a conference room, and there would be 20 or so people around the table and video link-ups around the world to various posts around the world where different generals would take their terms explaining a recent suicide that happened under their watch on their post. And they would have 5 minutes to talk about the suicide and also lessons learned from the suicide in an attempt to have some effect on these numbers. The startling thing to me, these meetings went on for 2 hours, and they never had enough time to keep up with all the suicides that were happening.
And the idea is that each one in some ways is different. So it's hard to sort of take all these and assume that we can change one policy and we'll fix the problem.
No, because patterns didn't emerge. Or if somebody thought a pattern was emerging, then a further study would kind of tear it apart a little bit. So you can see this in the aftercare as well. It's not just in the suicide meeting, Look, there's one guy I write about in the book. But let's go back to Tussolo Aiyede, the guy who was blown sky high and began having that terrible dream. So eventually he did crack open, and he needed help, and he got help in a VA program, a PTSD program at the Topeka VA hospital, inpatient, 7 weeks. And it was a good program for him. There's another guy, Nick Danino, who also needed help. And when he was ready to get help, when he was ready to acknowledge something was wrong and he needed help, Topeka was full. There was a waiting list. So they looked around for him and they found a program in Pueblo, Colorado. That one lasted 4 weeks. So now you have 4 weeks versus 7 weeks. One of the programs included other veterans from other wars. The other was strictly Iraq or Afghanistan. Is one better than the other? For Nick DiNino, well, it's just the Pueblo had an opening, so that's where he went. And then you get to Adam Schumann, the guy we were, you know, the great soldier who came home so filled with shame. And he finally got to the point where he acknowledged needing help. Topeka was full. Pueblo was full. And so his caseworker looked around and finally found this little program in Northern California where it wasn't insurance-supported or a VA system-supported program. It was run by private donations. And the minimum stay there is 4 months, and it's open-ended. You stay as long as you need to until you're feeling better. And that's where Adam Schumann got to go by the luck of the draw, and he will tell you it saved his life.
It was a good program for him, and but yet on the other side of things, you write about his wife Saskia still dealing with everything at home, and in her mind, as much as she knows her husband needs help, she's thinking, well, I want to go away to a hospital for a while and have all my needs taken care of.
Right. So, I mean, think about the implications of that. It's not that she was resentful of her husband trying to get help. She was angry and resentful over what their life had become. They had imagined a certain life. And not only didn't it work out, but because Adam finally had to come home from war early in the condition he was in, everything was upended. And their life became a scramble for money, a scramble for control, and a day-to-day life that seemed to be built on spiraling out of control. And it's almost like instead of having control of anything they did in the day was a reaction to something. And they were just trying to scramble back to normalcy. So he went out to this program, and she was resentful. She was angry because he was away, and she was still in the place where everything was falling apart, having to deal with everything. And Saskia, I mean, I know her well. She's amazing. She's a strong, strong person, and she also became a terribly angry person because of what their lives had become.
It has to be hard for both the soldiers and their families that I would imagine when they're separated by the war itself, there's at least a part of them that thinks, when I'm back home, when we're all together, nothing else will matter and everything will be okay. And then everything is so not okay that that's got to be a slap in the face.
Yeah. I think they both felt it. They would tell you they both felt that, along with all the other families I write about. I mean, but this isn't hard to make sense of, right?
Yeah.
You're going to war for whatever reasons, whether you're in the interior of the country, you can't find work, it's the best thing you have going. Nonetheless, when everybody went, I mean, I was with those guys when they went. I know them, and almost to a man, they were filled with a sense of mission, and they didn't know what they were getting into. And I guess no one who goes to war quite can know what they're getting into, otherwise they wouldn't go in the first place. And the luck of the draw again, they got a really tough neighborhood in East Baghdad. And these guys thought they, you know, they're 19 and 20-year-olds who thought they were invincible, that bad things happened to other people because those people weren't well-trained, they weren't as good a soldier. And then these guys lost their first guy, and they lost their second guy, and then they began losing ears and eyes and arms and legs and toes and fingers and control over their thoughts. And so war happened. And then they came home thinking, okay, well, at least I'm home now. Things are going to get a little bit better. But they've been finding out it's not so easy at home either.
And, of course, there are the families whose loved ones did not come home. And you write about Amanda Doster, and she's got this grief that sort of, I mean, I would sense that her feeling is no matter how damaged, I wish I could have my husband back.
Yeah. Amanda Doster was so interesting. Her husband was killed, and 3 years later, her level of grief was so deep, still so impossible to overcome, that you know, friends were losing patience with her. Enough's enough. It's time to get better. And of course, she'd be thinking the same thing: why can't I get better? But she was saying that as she might be driving around Kansas with a box of her husband's cremated remains buckled and strapped into the passenger seat beside her. She couldn't move on, and she didn't understand why she couldn't move on. She just knew she couldn't, even though everybody was telling her it's time to.
And she was sometimes really resentful of the sort of programs that were created to honor her loss, her husband's sacrifice. She almost felt on display.
Yeah, you know, that it's like I think a lot of folks feel that way, that they wonder about the authenticity of all these well-intended things that are being done here on behalf of soldiers and ex-soldiers. So Amanda and another woman I write about, Christy Robinson, they might get invited to things at Fort Riley in honor of their fallen husbands, and they would go. But at one part, they were grateful, but they also felt like they were being put on display a little bit. And I mean, these things happen. Again, the whole idea of good intentions and the absurdity of what these good intentions can turn into are reflected in the book. There are so many people I met in the course of reporting who are trying so hard to do the right thing here. And sometimes it works and sometimes it doesn't. There was this example of a hunt being put on in western Kansas. And Adam Schumann was invited to this weekend away. He and his family, come here. We'll give you a free hotel room. The guys can hunt. There are activities for children. For women, if you want to, you can have a massage. You can have time to just sort of, your kids will be taken care of and you'll be pampered a little bit. That was the idea, a pretty nice idea. And the Schumanns headed toward that. Adam had just come through a bad episode where he had tried to commit suicide, and everybody was feeling so tender. And they head out to western Kansas. They have a fight, as they often did. Adam does a U-turn in the road and drops Saskia and the kids back home and continues on his way out to this hunt. And what happens, the first thing that happens is they gather everybody into a ballroom, they welcome them, and they give everybody a gift. And the gift is a shotgun. And suddenly, Adam Schumann, who just got rid of his shotgun after trying to kill himself, is in possession of a shotgun again.
Can you tell us about Patty Walker?
Patty Walker is so interesting. She was a caseworker at Fort Riley whose job was to take on some of the most mentally wounded guys of all and help them make the transition out of the Army and into civilian life. And as I write in the book, she had 49 soldiers to take care of during the day. And at night, she'd go home to her 50th client, who was her husband, Kevin, who had been severely wounded earlier in the Iraq War. And to spend time in Patty Walker's office and see the parade of people coming in, of wounded soldiers asking for help, it was quite eye-opening to see the level of need and the level of hope that these people would bring as they came into her office and asked for help. And, you know, Patty, she's an emotional person, tough, strong, capable of big sighs and sudden tears and hugs. And she's the one who, when Adam was at the end of his rope, found the program in California for him. And she's the one who was quite surprised to read the book recently and find out that when Adam went out there, Saskia was so upset with Patty Walker, she was saying things like, "I just want to punch that woman in the face for ruining my life."
Hmm. You know, the thought of people sacrificing and working even in a flawed environment like the VA and like these programs is really interesting, because they are very often not limited by a lack of caring or good intentions, as you've said, but resources. And I'm curious about how things are sort of evidence tested to figure out what does work best for the majority of returning veterans who have mental wounds.
Well, there were things like, I mean, a lot of these places practice something called CPT, cognitive processing therapy, which has been shown again and again to be pretty effective in treating people who have suffered some kind of trauma, whether military or the civilian side. And there are other treatment protocols as well. I mean, these people aren't flying by the seat of their pants. They know what is supposed to work in theory. Mm-hmm. And they try hard. But again, place to place is where it degrades and falls apart a little bit, because as happens with so many things, some places are good and some places are less good. But if you're a guy who's gone over and served, and you've come back, and you finally reach the point where you're overcoming stigma and asking for help, I think underneath that request is the hope that you're going to be sent to the best place of all. And it doesn't always work out that way.
Does the help run out? I mean, for those who are not getting better for whatever reason, is there a point at which they're told, we're sorry, we've done all we could?
Yeah, I mean, episodically. Look, the place in Colorado where Nick Danino went, which relies on insurance, what insurance allows is a stay of 28 days. Now, that can be extended for a week in certain circumstances, but you go to that place, you get 28 days to work it out.
Mm-hmm.
You go to the VA program, you get 7 weeks to work it out. You go to the place in California, you get 4 months to work it out. So you could see the differences. And, an interesting thing, when I was trying to figure out why two people standing side by side and the same traumatizing event happens to both of them, and one does okay with it and one doesn't do okay with it, what's the difference? And so I got various explanations from different therapists. And one said, it's not the moment of trauma that's so important. It's the first moment after the trauma, the first moment when you're in control of yourself, and how you behave in that moment, how you think you behaved, whether you were brave or cowardly. That's what's so important to figure out. Another therapist said, yeah, that's true, except to me what makes sense is it's not who you were in the moment after the trauma, but who you were in the moment before, the patterns of your life that led up to the trauma. And that explains everything since. That made a lot of sense, too.
David Finkel is my guest. He's a MacArthur Prize-winning journalist who writes and edits for The Washington Post. His new book is called Thank You for Your Service.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. You can learn to navigate the ever-changing digital landscape with the Social Media and Digital Communication Boot Camp, June 4th through 6th at SMU in Plano. Details and registration at smu.edu/think.
You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour from the studios of The Washington Post with David Finkel, who writes and edits for the paper and has just published a new book called Thank You for Your Service. An email here from Sandeep asks, what is the private group where Adam Schumann got help, and do they accept donations?
The group's called The Pathway Home. It's in Yountville, California, and they do accept donations. I mean, it's a week-to-week scramble to stay afloat. They started, I think they had a $5 million donation that got them off the ground, and it kept them going for a few years. But I talk to them frequently, and they're hanging in there, but it's not a sure thing month to month for those guys.
Did they feel, the professionals there, that they are getting a better handle on how to help these individuals as the years pass?
Yeah. But I think if you talk to any of the folks that are in the programs in Pueblo and Topeka, they're all thinking the same thing, because they're just the sample size keeps getting larger, and they're able to see more clearly what works and what doesn't. But I don't think anybody would disagree that it's still a pretty haphazard thing.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go to Harvey in Josephine. Hi, Harvey.
How are you doing?
Great, thank you.
What an awesome topic. It's dear to my heart. I've got a couple, it'd be statements, more than questions. I'd just like to get your feedback on it. One would be, when we look at heroism, let's take the situation where there's a grenade that lands on the ground, and there's five men there, and one man instinctively jumps on it. Well, maybe three of the other four bounce for cover, and the fourth guy is completely frozen. And we wonder why, what made the one man jump. And what I've come up with is the fact that for the one man, it would be easier to die than to live with knowing that he didn't do something.
That's very interesting. What do you think, David?
Well, I wonder if you can think that clearly in such a moment. Maybe Harvey's right. Maybe you have those same five guys. It's a day later. A different grenade, but the same situation. And it's somebody else who jumps on it, and the other four get out of the way. After being with soldiers during the deployment in difficult situations, and being in some of those situations myself, you know, are you really in control of your first reaction? I'm just not sure. And can instinct be that predictable? I'm not sure about that either.
Did you have any experience of anything like PTSD when you returned from your time as an embedded journalist?
No, it's interesting. I've been thinking about that at various times, but lately, in terms of the whole idea of CPT of this cognitive processing therapy, where people are supposed to be taken again and again to the traumatizing event to think it through or to write about it, perhaps to the point where they can control the thoughts, or maybe they're numbed by a little bit. I think one guy in the book who's leading a therapy group calls it habituation. It makes more sense to me when I think that I came home pretty rattled from my experience over there, and spent 9 months taking this big pile of chronological notes and arranging it into a narrative of what happened to these guys. So in a sense, every day I was revisiting these things and thinking them through and making sense of them. And maybe that's one of the reasons I came out of it okay. Well, another reason is, look, I'm not a soldier. I was there. Bad things happened. But in no way was I facing the stresses and pressures that a modern American soldier faces.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Paul on the line now in Bedford. Hello, Paul.
Hi. I called in actually yesterday, and I've got this burning question, because to me it sounds as though, and I'm going to kind of ask your author to stretch out a little bit here, because yesterday you had a program on about football players who suffered trauma and who... You know, you get suicides from that. You get all kinds of problems as a result of that.
They have brain injuries.
Now you're talking about soldiers coming back home, having suffered trauma, suicides, and all of that coming along. It used to be, at least the way I see it, when we were quote unquote a great nation, we didn't worry about these guys. You know, it's kind of like that was just a part of it, and now we're concerned about these kind of things. We're talking about these kind of things. Does that make us any less great because we're talking about these kind of things than when we were, you know, when we didn't pay them any attention before, and we were considered to be a great nation? I don't know if that makes sense to you or not.
What do you think, David?
Well, it does make sense to me, and I think I'm not comfortable giving opinions on too many things. It's not the journalism I do, but maybe I will stretch here, like the caller asked. I think if you agree that this is a great nation, the fact that we're paying attention to this, however flawed the attention is, the fact that we're paying attention and we're not turning away and we're not pretending it's not going on, to me that falls into the definition of a great nation. It's an exercise in caring and. I think that's a pretty good thing.
Yeah, it does seem that, you know, denying that it exists so that you can see yourself as a sort of omnipotent society doesn't take the problem away for the individuals who are affected.
No. And it probably makes it easier for everybody if we're finally paying serious attention to the idea that this does go on. I'm not naive enough to think a book like this is going to change policy here in Washington. It's not like war policy will change because there's an exploration of the private lives of people trying to recover from war. But I do think it'll have an effect on how people think about the after war. And wars come and go, and they begin and they end. But the after war, it's a continuing thing. It's open ended. I can't pretend that these 500,000 folks, or at least the ones I know among the 500,000, just because I've written about them, doesn't mean that it's a closed chapter, a closed deal. Their struggles go on and will go on in various ways for the rest of their lives, just as people we know from World War II, from Korea, from Vietnam, they may get better, but it's not like anyone regains perfection after having such profound experiences.
Back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Tuesday on the line in Forney. Hello, Tuesday.
Hi, I just wanted to make a comment about the origins of thought, instinctual thoughts, and I just wanted to say that from what I found in my studies is that a person's instinctual thought, like the young man diving on the grenade, is something that has been developed within their experiences growing up, that it's something that you play in your head, be it consciously or subconsciously, that you're going to do something heroic. For example, when I'm a professor at Eastville College and I tell my students and I play it through my head, and I needless to say I'm ex-military war veteran myself, but I play it through my head that if something was to happen at our college, that I'm not going to stand by and allow my students to be harmed, that I will be the person that goes out front and try and protect them while they're en route to safety. And so it's something for me personally, not everyone, but for me personally, it is something that I think about prior to. Now, does it mean that I'm going to respond like that exactly in that way? Maybe, maybe not. But it's definitely something that that I think through consciously.
Well, that's really interesting, Tuesday. I appreciate the call. Is there anything you wanted to respond to there, David?
It really is interesting. The idea that you can rehearse for such a moment, it fascinates me. And it kind of squares up with what happens out in California at the Pathway Home. The guy who runs it, Fred Gussman, who was in the VA for a long time and now is running this program, he's the one who was stressing to me, it matters who you were in the moment before the traumatic event. And what he gets to do, because he has the luxury of time with these guys, is basically tear them down and back to the beginning and helps these guys see the patterns of their lives, the impressions, the things that impressed them that led them to who they were in the moment before the trauma. Which helps them understand why they might have behaved in the way they did after the traumatic event. So again, there's the luxury of time, and I think it fits into what your caller was saying. It's understanding how you might be based on who you've been through the previous days and weeks and years of your life.
Tell us about your title, Thank You for Your Service. This is what we all sort of understand we are to say when we meet someone who has served the country's interest, particularly on the battlefield. Talk about why you chose that phrase in particular.
Well, we've all heard the phrase quite a bit. Mm-hmm. It's ubiquitous. And in most cases, in some cases, yes, it's an easy phrase. It's just the easy go-to phrase. My sense, and the soldier sense, is that it's usually well-intended and earnest, but that doesn't mean it comes with full understanding. So I chose the title because I think if you read the book, you'll get a better sense of who you're thanking and what you're thanking them for.
Tell us a little bit about what it took for you. I mean, you've known these guys since 2007. What did it take to sort of maintain your professional role with them when after a time and you're spending all this time with them, I have to imagine you came to think of them as friends.
Well, not as friends, but
most people
my
you cared about?
Well, sure. Of course I care about them. I mean, who wouldn't and who couldn't? They're fully interesting human beings. Yes, they're wounded, but they're also they're angry. They're funny. They're human beings trying hard, as hard as I've seen human beings try, to heal and get better. But I've been doing this for a long time. I I think I know how to do it pretty well. It's a kind of journalism that doesn't involve interviews so much as just being present and asking people to trust me enough to confide in me, to let me see them at their best and their worst and all the things in between, so I can accurately reflect their stories, what they're going through. And, you know, credibility, they didn't trust me at first with the first book because they didn't know what a reporter was or did or does. And there were a lot of rumors about what I was up to, how I had an agenda. I didn't, but those were the rumors. But the fact that I stayed with those guys, the length of their deployment, that I didn't visit and go away thinking I knew something, but that I stayed. And then when bad things happened and the smoke cleared and they saw me at the edge with a notebook or a recorder, I think that helped with my credibility as well. The danger was that they might forget what the relationship was, that I was someone they could confess to and I wasn't writing a book or something like that. So there was always a signal, a notebook, a tape recorder, just something to remind them of what the deal was. I'm here. I want to listen. I want to watch. I want to see. I want to write your story. But that's the intent, to write what's going on, not for them, but for all kinds of people who don't know them and may not care about them. And it was up to them whether to trust that or not. And in this case, I think they did, with the idea that people can read their stories and maybe they'll have a better understanding of what the real deal is.
I read somewhere that there's discussion of a movie version of this book.
Yes. Yes, there is discussion.
Is that frightening? Given, I mean, there's the book is beautifully written and it's so nuanced. And do you have any concerns that this could turn into something that you didn't intend it to be if it's put on screen?
No, because the person who's interested in making the movie makes beautiful movies, and I have fingers crossed that it'll happen because you know I've tried hard on this book and I hope people read it, but it's not the same as a movie. As so many more people will see a movie than read a book, and the intent here, underneath everything, is to get people to pay particular attention and care about what's happening right now. And, you know, the book's trying, but a movie could increase the sense of information tenfold.
And I'll just say it because you wouldn't. The person who's thinking about making this is Steven Spielberg. Is that correct?
I have a long contract that says I can't really talk.
All right, I'll let it go with that. Maybe it was just my outspoken speech. David Finkel writes for the Washington Post. His new book is called Thank You for Your Service. David, it's been a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Sorry about that last answer.
That's okay. Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is assistant producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.